You know that you've officially chosen an interesting career when there is not one, but two BBC sitcoms about your job. A lot of people ask me if I've seen the show Vicar of Dibley. But there's another BBC sitcom about a minister, because one couldn't be enough, called Rev. Has anybody seen Rev? Rev is similar to Vicar of Dibley, but it tells the story of a minister working in an urban setting. It's a guy named Reverend Adam Smallbone, and all of the drama and ridiculousness of his life. And the show is hilarious, but it's also profound. One of the recurring characters is a guy named Colin, who hangs out with Reverend Adam a lot, and Colin drinks all the time and smokes everywhere, and he swears, and he is just generally as inappropriate as he can possibly be at every opportunity. But he loves the church, and he loves Reverend Adam, and he just shows up at everything all the time. My worship professor, coincidentally also a minister named Adam, told me that this is the part of the show that is the most like real ministry. Adam said, when you're a minister to a congregation, the person that you will find yourself getting to know the best, the person you will find yourself connecting with most often, is not the person that you have the most in common with. And it's not the person that you would imagine. It's the person that you see the most. It's the person you interact with the most. The person who volunteers a lot or serves on a lot of committees or, like Colin, is just always kind of there. And these relationships that you will form, Adam told me, will be the most vital ones in your ministry, because they will teach you the most about ministry and they will teach you the most about yourself. I want to tell you guys a story about a relationship that taught me a lot about myself. When I got out of college, I got a job as a barista, serving coffee and fancy espresso in Boston. I know that, you know, picturing, you know, a guy in his early 20s with earrings and a degree in poetry from Hampshire College, getting a degree as a, you know, getting a degree and then ending up as a barista, that must be a real stretch. Shocking, even. And I'm sorry to tell you that I had all of the pretension and elitism that we associate with, you know, the guys making coffee in the trendy cafes. And I was able to do a really good barista face when someone came in and ordered a decaf, and I was writing the order down the... There's a note here in my notes to just let you guys know, to show my progression as a human being between then and now. As I wrote in the sermon, you know, show them the barista face, I was drinking decaf coffee as I wrote that, just to show you that I was far from the minister that I am now, and I still hope that I'm far from the minister that I will be. So when I got off work every day at the cafe, on my way home, I would stand at the subway platform at North Station next to a guy named Born Again Bob. And Born Again Bob, it's just not enough to call him a street evangelist, because that doesn't do justice to how intense he is. He wears a sandwich board that has really vivid pictures of people burning in hell on it. And you might have seen him. He's at most big events in the city of Boston. And he stands there and he hands out chick tracts, which are these ultra right-wing comic books that I have a very different theology than mine. I find them to be offensive and disturbing and also weirdly funny. So I would stand at the station next to Born Again Bob, and he was there every day, and at first I'd argue with him, more than was really worth it. And then I would make fun of him in ways that I'm not proud of. And then for weeks we just stood there in silence, just sort of glaring at the ground. Until eventually I looked over and I saw the person standing behind the sandwich board. And I saw that Bob's cheeks were sunken, and that his eyes were bloodshot, and that he was very, very, very thin and not wearing a coat, and that he was shaking. And in my, you know, disinterested, trying to be callous 22-year-old way, I kind of said, "You're right, man. Like, you, what's going on, dude?" And he told me he hadn't eaten in a couple of days. And he told me that he lives on the street. And that he has no job and no income, and that he just depends on people who believe in his message to take him in and feed him and give him a place to sleep, the way that he knows Jesus would have done. And so I said, "Hang on a minute, bro." So I walked back to the cafe. And you know, at the end of the day at a cafe that serves food, all the food is that's left over at the end of the day, it's pitched out or given to the employees. When you work at a cafe, almost everything you eat is leftover cafe food. So I got some sandwiches and I brought them back to Bob, and this just kind of became our thing that we would do every day. I would show up at the station and I would bring Bob a sandwich, and we would make small talk about things that weren't religion. Bob really likes to fish, for example, and we would eat our leftover sandwiches, and he would try to get me to go to heaven, and I would say no thank you, and then I would get on my train and I would go home. And that was just what my winter that year ended up being. And smart mouths Boston kids like me would walk by and make fun of Bob, and I found myself doing the Boston thing, you know, "Hey, keep it walking, buddy." And I had done the same thing that they had done a few weeks earlier, and I totally agreed with their criticisms of what Bob was doing, but somehow, just through sheer force of being stuck with each other, Bob had become something dangerously close to my friend. And now I see him around Boston at various things, and I greet him, and I say, "Bob, how are you?" And my friends, who were all liberal seminarians, go, "What are you doing? Get away!" Like, they think I've gone crazy. And Bob has the same reaction, because I look a lot different now. And so he thinks I'm just some crazy person who happens to know his name. But I think about the time that he and I spent together in the freezing cold, eating day-old sandwiches. And I think that was just not a great time in my life. You know, I was really into the whole miserable, wounded poet aesthetic. You know, I spent a lot of time at open mics wailing about my tortured soul. I was cold. I was broke, and I was so unbelievably sick of eating leftover cafe sandwiches. And Bob clearly was not having a good time himself. But I'm totally certain that those brief moments in our days were so much better because we spent them together. The great poet Marge Piercy writes, "Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope." And while I don't plan on giving Bob a massage, I like to think that he and I, if nothing else, did help keep each other sane. And I think about Reverend Adam from the show Rev and his parishioner Colin and the time they spend together and how they sort of keep each other sane. And then we get to Frog and Toad. I was looking around for a sacred text to reference on Martin Luther King Day. Everybody was referencing, you know, saying you should really use something out of the Bible. And I said, "Now we're going to do Frog and Toad." Frog and Toad are heading up the mountain together. They're off on their journey. They are encountering terrible, difficult things, but they have each other. And they insist that they are not afraid. And they shout, I am not afraid. And by shouting that they are not afraid, they help each other have courage. Like Marge Piercy says, they give hope, conviction, support, even when they get home, even when it is time to digest and process the horrific experience they have just had, they have each other. My friends, I don't need to tell you this has been a very difficult few weeks for our nation and for our world. Really, it's been a bad year in a lot of ways. After this past summer of violence with ISIL, Eric Garner and Michael Brown decisions, and the subsequent and further protests in Ferguson, Missouri, and all over the country, the recent shootings in Paris, and on and on, it's hard not to be afraid. It's hard not to feel despair. It's hard not to feel beat up. My instinct when I'm surrounded by difficult and painful things like this is not always as heroic or as noble as I would like to think that it is. I have a tendency to retreat. I think of myself as an activist and an advocate, but sometimes things seem so hopeless that I can't help but want to shut down, retreat into myself, and ignore what is happening around me. This is not always a bad thing. There are moments when we need to retreat. There are moments when we need to take care of ourselves so that we can be strong enough to continue to work for justice. We have to walk a fine line between taking care of ourselves and retreating into a safe, privileged place and never coming back. Tomorrow, of course, is Martin Luther King Day. As we enter Martin Luther King Day tomorrow, I think about the plague of racism that still affects our country and indeed the entire world. I think about all of the work that remains to be done. I think about Dr. King's famous dream of equality that seems so impossibly far away. And I think we're all a lot like Frog and Toad, standing at the foot of an impossibly steep mountain, and this mountain has snakes and avalanches and hawks and more. But as Unitarian Universalists, we climb. We climb by campaigning, by organizing, by marching and demonstrating and writing letters and voting. But we Unitarian Universalists cannot do this alone. This is when we get back to the need for people who can keep us sane, who can give us hope, the need for allies. And they may not be the allies that we would have pictured, but the allies we get are the allies we get when we need them. As Unitarian Universalists, we have a vital role to play in the continuing civil rights movement, but we cannot do this work alone. We're too small, and we're too weird. And that's not a bad thing. I tell people all the time, it is not a bad thing to be a small religious movement, and I sure hope it isn't a bad thing to be weird, because I really like being weird. I plan to stay weird. A few weeks ago, I was marching in Boston as a part of a Black Lives Matter protest. Incidentally, I did actually run into Bob at that march. I was walking with my friend Brian, who's a rabbinical student at Hebrew College, which is the rabbinical school that shares its campus with my seminary. And it was a beautiful thing to be there. And there were all different kinds of people there, thousands and thousands of people. And we marched and we sang. And then, as sometimes happens at marches, things started to get ugly. The street was blocked by a line of police officers with clubs, and they collided with the front of the group of marchers. They were about as far from me as maybe four pews in. And people started shouting, and people were pushing, and people were getting hurt. And I had never been to a protest that turned violent before. And it didn't feel poetically beautiful or heroic in the way that I imagined it would. And I was afraid. And everybody in the crowd was told to link arms, and on one arm I had my friend Brian. And it felt really good to have Brian there with me. And on the other arm, I had some guy, Brian's friend from somewhere. And so there we were. The UU seminarian, the rabbinical student, and the rabbinical student's friend. It was like a weird three guys walk into a bar joke. But we gave each other strength. And we gave each other hope. And just like Frog and Toad, marching up the mountain together, holding hands, telling each other that we weren't afraid. And when it was time to run, we ran. Because something that it's important to know about protesting is that sometimes it's time to run. And when it's time to run back down the mountain, you run. And so we ran. And we ran past North Station, and we ended up, I'm not making this up, at a certain cafe where I had worked a few years earlier, right after I got out of college. And we talked, and we calmed down, and we kept each other sane and gave each other hope. Earlier in the service, we sang the song, "Guide My Feet While I Run This Race." And I love that song. The assumption, I think, is that you're talking to God, right? It's a prayer. Guide my feet while I run this race. But Unitarian Universalists obviously have no qualms about messing with other people's hymns. So we're going to mess with this one a little bit. Because I like to think of that hymn in a different way. Because as a Unitarian Universalist, I don't know if I believe in a God that will actually move my feet along. But John Paul Sartre said that hell is other people. So I think maybe God gets to be other people right now. So when we're asking God, hold my hand as I run this race, I think in this case we can also be asking the person next to us to hold our hand as we run this race. Whether that person next to us is our best friend and fellow amphibian, or our beloved colleague, as it was in my case, or some kid who hangs out with our beloved colleague, as it also was in my case, or even a stranger, or even some guy in a hateful sandwich board handing out weird comic books. What is so beautiful about the hymn is that it's not a prayer for victory. It's a prayer for companionship on the way to victory. And I think as Unitarian Universalists, that's something we can really get behind. It's not smash the state. It's not shut it down. It's guide my feet. Walk with me. Hold my hand. Because I can't do this alone. Because I am tired and I am afraid and I need you. Because I don't want to run this race in vain. Blessed be and amen. If you will now please rise in body or in spirit and join in singing hymn number 1018 in the teal hymnal, "Come and Go With Me."